My name's Mike. I'm an alcoholic. Say nothing else tonight. Those are the three most important things in my life. I have a date, which I know that I stopped drinking. You don't know when you stop. I have a sponsor who I still talk to regularly. And anymore, pretty much, he tells me to do something, I just kind of try and do it. There was a time when I'd give him a lot of back talk, but he would give me answers like, "This is America. You can do whatever you want." At which point, I start crying because I know this is going to be really bad. Because my decisions have never been good. And actually, I talked to him on my way down here. We were going to stop at the truck stop back up the road. And he says, "No, no, no. Go into town and eat in town." So if you hear a bunch of snoring, it's because we all had barbecue at the place in town. So it was really good. And I have a home group. It meets in an hour and a half, actually. And if I miss it 1 week, they're like, "Okay." If I miss it 2 or 3 weeks, somebody's like calling or like, "Where are you at? What's going on? Why aren't you here?" And I'll usually have some type of job in my home group. Currently I don't, but generally I have a job. And I'm accountable, and people, you know what I'm doing. And whether it's my sponsor or my friends or whatever, they know what I'm up to. So there's not a whole life of secrets anymore. I will endeavor to not cuss. Makes my wife very upset when I cuss, and she's in the room, so I can't lie and say I didn't cuss, so we'll try. We'll see what happens. It's kind of a joke with people who know me. I'll certainly try no F-bombs. I think the count one night in one meeting was like 20 or 30 or something. I was on a roll that night. So I'll endeavor to behave myself a little bit. I wasn't born in Washington, D.C. area, though I was raised there. I was born in Texas. I'm rather proud of that fact, so I'm going to say it. Plus, I have a guy sponsored from Ohio, and, you know, it's better than Ohio for sure, so, you know. I grew up, and really, you know, I'm alcoholic, and I'm grandiose. And Texas is like Texas, right? But I lived there from age 0 to age 1, so it's not like, you know, I was there long. So. But that's how I am. I mean, I got big ego and, you know, big ideas and very little action and very, very poor results. And, you know, but I, as far back as I can remember, though, I've been in trouble. I have always, you know, always been in trouble. And I was certainly a ready, fire, aim kind of kid. And when I was growing up, there was still 5 and 10 stores. And I could go to the 5 and 10 store, and they had, you know, 10 cent, well, they're probably quarter baseball cards. And this is how good of a thief I am. I would grab a stack of them, and you could use the bathroom in most stores back then. They were still kind of friendly about that. And I would unwrap them, and I'd stuff the wrappers in the trash can, and then I'd put the cards in my pocket and leave. Now, if you do that once or twice, they probably don't notice. But when you do that day after day after day after day, you end up with, and they showed me, I had a full, the trash can was like this big, and it was full of baseball card wrappers when they caught me. That's how good of a thief I am. Not very good. But I'll do it and do it till I get caught. I mean, I'm going for it till somebody's, till it's a brick wall, a cop, my mother, you know, something. I'm doing it. And I'm the same way. I decide I want to, like, eat hamburgers. I'm going to eat hamburgers until I can't eat no more hamburgers. Day after day after day after day. I'm like a, you know, puppy dog. I get my attention fixed on something, and we're going with it, baby. And I don't, you know, I'm not stopping. Ask my wife. She hates motorcycles. I want a motorcycle, and she just, you know, it was like over. You know, every day. I want a motorcycle. I want a motorcycle. That's how I am. Been that way my whole life. I've been that way, just Chinese water torture. And, you know, and I was that kind of kid. I was a brat. I'm the youngest with two older sisters. My dad was a lawyer. We grew up in Montgomery County, Maryland. There was never a want for anything. Actually, I wanted all kinds of stuff. I never did without them. I can't claim any type of hardship in my life. You know, the worst thing I could claim was one time I got in trouble and my dad started spanking me, and back then they used the belt, and I'd have to go get the belt. Now, why I would bring the belt back, I still don't understand, but I would go get the belt and bring it back so they could spank me, right? And he wasn't stopping. I mean, he was going to town on me. Now, there was a good reason for it. My mom had to pull him off. But like a year before, we were renting a house, and I was playing with matches and almost burnt the house down. My dad and my mother had worked hard to buy a house. And they had bought this house. We had just moved in, and I'm in the bedroom, in the closet, playing with matches again. And he goes, "Were you playing with matches now?" And I was like 6, 7. And I go, "Okay, I'm going to tell the truth this time." I never told the truth. I always blamed it on my sister, my middle sister. Why she didn't kill me in my sleep, I don't know. But I would, my hand could be in the cookie jar, and I'm going, "Sharon did it." That's what I do, you know. And so I said, "Okay, I'll tell the truth." And I told the truth. I still got my ass beat. Okay, in my mind. So, I ain't telling the truth ever again. At least if I lie, I got a chance of getting out of it. You know? So, and those are the ideas I developed over, you know, just growing up. I hadn't even taken a drink yet. But those are the ideas I'm coming up with. We had a next door neighbor. These people never did anything to me. Never. They were nice people. Other than being Cowboy fans, they were nice people. And, They had this big plate glass window in the front of their house. Now, not once, not twice, but 3 times I just walked over with a cinder block. Okay? Next door neighbor. There was no reason for it. And I mean, you know, once maybe just for grins, but 3 times. And the only reason it stopped is because some guy was like, you know, here I'm looking at the window, and he's right behind me 10 feet and watches me throw it through the window, and I got a white shirt on and run back to my house. I mean, that's the only reason I'm stopped, I'm sure, because somebody caught me. I'd have kept on doing it. And so, and I don't know why. I just did those things. I was restless. I twitched. I just twitched. I mean, when I was little, I got caught for stealing Christmas lights, and when I was little, they were really big, and they'd make a lot of noise when you throw them up against somebody's house, and now if somebody touched my Christmas lights, if my wife didn't kill him, I'd kill him, you know. But, so I just was always into something. And I wasn't, you know, like I said, there was no reason for me to be into something. And I got diagnosed at a young age, about third grade, with, they call it attention deficit disorder. When I was little, they called it something a lot cooler, I think. I was called hyperactive with minimal brain dysfunction. I like that. That sounds better than attention deficit disorder. And what happened was they gave me speed, dextrine. It's speed. My sister's friends would want to steal it. And for whatever reason, and it shouldn't have happened, but it also would keep me up at night. So they gave me speed and some type of sleeping tablet. I took one of each every morning from third grade through sixth grade. Now, that wouldn't be so bad. I mean, my parents were trying to help me. They were trying to take care of me. And I don't remember having, like, real ill will towards my parents for it, because I didn't. But none of my little buddies were talking about taking drugs in the morning. Okay? Couple that with the first year on this stuff, I got to go to group therapy on Friday afternoon after school. The problem with Friday afternoon after school, and I don't know about you guys, but the school I went to, we played soccer and football and baseball on Friday afternoon after school. So instead of going and playing soccer and football and baseball, I got to come home and go to group therapy. And the therapist was a nice guy. People, wasn't there pretty nice. I mean, we're all whacked, but it was pretty nice. And, you know, but again, it wouldn't have been so bad, but none of my little buddies that I wanted to play football with were in group therapy. If they were, they weren't talking about it. So I'm feeling different. I was the youngest with two older sisters. I was a brat, and I got picked on pretty good as a kid, mainly because I just would run my mouth incessantly, and they would just finally stuff me in a trash can or something, you know. So I just got this going, and I'm just, you know, running around, living life, I guess, being a little kid. I don't necessarily, other than the trouble, I don't necessarily, and I don't feel as good as ever. Like, I would look at the other kids, and they always seemed a little cooler, a little hipper, a little slicker. I mean, I just didn't feel quite up to snuff. But it wasn't like I was having a bad life. I mean, I was going to school and getting fed and, you know, having the fun I was having and having puppy dogs and, you know, just being a kid. And long about just before sixth grade, my mom called me by my full name. I'm outside playing and she called my full name. And when the full name comes, I know I'm in trouble. Because that's the only time I ever heard my full name. My full name's Philip Michael Pickerel. She's like, come here now. So I'm like, I'm in trouble. And I go into the kitchen and I sit down and my mom and dad look at me and they go, we're getting a divorce. Now, mind you, this is 1973 or 74. My family was probably the second family in the neighborhood, or at least on our block, that got a divorce. And it'd be, you know, so, but again, it's not like, you know, it was what it was. So, but, and I watched this happen, and I kind of, even as a kid, I knew this was, I knew something was wrong, because some weeks before, I come tromping up to the kitchen door, and I see my mom kissing the wrong man. I'm like, and I just make a U-turn and go, I'm out of here. I mean, I don't walk through the door, you know. And then my dad cries at the kitchen table. I'd never seen my dad cry ever. Ever. So, and none of the, and like, and I'll say this, none of this stuff makes me an alcoholic. What did happen, though, is all these things are going into my brain, and I'm coming up with ideas about life and about things that I'm going to play out from then on, that I won't even understand what I'm doing until I didn't even understand some of it until I was 13, 15 years sober. Okay? That I came up with ideas just, you know, like I said, I ain't ever telling the truth again. Another thing I'll tell you is I was in like ninth grade and we were out drinking and this girl gave me a light and I said thank you and my buddies laughed at me. I never was polite again, ever. Never said thank you again. You know, you laugh at me for, I'm not saying thank you again. It ain't going to happen. And it didn't for a long time. But one of the first things I had to learn about in sobriety was how to say good morning to people. Because you'd say good morning and I would, if you were lucky, I would just growl. If you were unlucky and I was feeling particularly special, you'd get an F-bomb, including my mother. I mean, I just was like that. I mean, my mom would say good morning, and I would just look at her, like, leave me alone. And so I just had, and the other side is, and the magic of AA, or the magic of meetings for me, was a place where I can go and talk about these things that go on inside of me and these ideas. And because certainly, other than that group therapy I told you about, other than that, there was no place in my life with my parents that they might have, but I didn't watch my parents talk to each other about problems they were having. My sisters didn't, you know, we didn't talk. I was like 5 and 6 years younger than my older sisters. Now, maybe they were talking about stuff to my parents, but I wasn't. And, you know, So I had no outlet. My outlet was a cinder block through your window. My outlet was getting drunk, because around then I took my first drink, and running up and down the street jumping on your car. Because I feel free now, and I'm happy, and this works. Because I started drinking when I was 10 years old, and I'm sure I know a lot of people who start drinking when they're 10 years old. I started smoking drugs, taking drugs and drinking at like age 10. And the irony of that was when my son was like 9, I looked at him and I was like, please, dear God, no. Knowing that it's not my call. Knowing that, and he's 19 now, and I hope and pray every day he's not alcoholic, but it's not my call. It's not up to me. And so what happened is I got this and I'm doing this stuff and I've always been, you know, I'm not, you know, the lead dog specifically, but I'm like right up at the front of the line pulling shit. I don't shy away too well. I mean, if you get me, and I talk about this a lot. There's a lot of things, thank God, I never did in my drinking. I never put a needle in my arm because nobody ever put a needle in front of me. I have friends who robbed banks that are sober. I didn't hang out with bank robbers when I was drinking, or I'd have done what they did. I hung out with people who would go to the bar and get into bar fights. I hung out with people who we would see somebody on the side of the road, and just for giggles, we would get out and beat their ass. I did the things that they did. Okay? So there's no virtue to the things I didn't do. I just didn't hang out with those kind of people. Okay? I drank. I didn't care about... I really didn't give a rat's ass about anybody. If I had to say I cared about anything, if I had a dog, I cared about that. But at the end of the day, after my 18th birthday, I had the best dog I had ever had up until that point. I was living in Michigan, and I was supposed to go to college. And I had come back to Washington to see my sister before she moved to California, and I never even saw her. I was drinking with my buddies, because the drinking age in Washington was 18. In Michigan at that time, it was 21, and I was living in Michigan at the time. I never saw my sister. By midnight that night, me and a friend of mine are in his car on our way to Ocean City, because that's what I do. I start drinking, that's where I'm going, baby. I'm done. We're out of here. I'm going somewhere. I don't know where, but we're going. And I hitchhiked back from Ocean City because my mom, I called her. She said, where are you? I go, Ocean City. She says, we're leaving tomorrow, with or without you. I'm like, okay. Didn't faze me. And it didn't faze me the fact that my mother was probably terrified. I didn't care. It didn't matter to me. And what happened was, is I hitchhiked from Ocean City back to Bethesda, Maryland. Spent the night at my sister's house. Got up the next day, walked out to 270 North, stuck my thumb out, and hitchhiked back to Detroit. Went to sleep, woke up the next day, looked at my mother, I said, I'm moving. And now this is how much that dog cared. I cared about that dog. And I'll tell you something, if you had asked me how much I'd have told you, I love that dog more than anything. Okay? I packed my stuff up. I put the dog in the car. I went to the Humane Society. And gave that dog away so that I could come back to Washington, D.C. to drink. That's what I do. I'm not some gangster. I'm not some big badass. Never been. But that's what I do. I am selfish and self-centered completely to this day. Without some type of program of recovery, that's how I act. That's what I do. I don't care about anything but taking a drink. That's all I want to do. That's all I ever wanted once I started drinking. Okay? Because when I drank, I could go, I could breathe. All of a sudden, it was okay. And I was riding around on my motorcycle last night with my roommate. And I had a friend the other day talk about, it smells like drinking. And last night smelled like drinking. I know that smell in the springtime when it's about 65 degrees out and the sun's down and it's just a nice night. Smells like drinking. I know that. Almost 20 years later, I still know what that is. I don't got alcoholism. I got alcoholism. I love drinking. I won't ever say a bad thing about drinking. I loved it. Okay? Everything about it. I love the fighting. Just like I loved AA the same way. I love everything about AA. All the crap, all the craziness, all the drama, all of it. All the good stuff. I love it all. I loved it with drinking. I loved it all. I didn't like the handcuffs and the cops so much, but hey, you know, a little price for fun, you know, who cares? You know, the only thing, you know, and so I did these things, and that's how I acted. And by the time I was 15 years old, my father had had enough, and getting arrested at 14, 15 years old for breaking into houses kind of annoys your lawyer father, and I'm just a pain in the butt. I'm not, you know, I wasn't a good son by any stretch. And he was just tired of watching me. He was tired of putting up with this little brat, this little monster. And he packed me up and sent me to Michigan to live with my mom. My mom lived outside of East Detroit, Michigan. If anybody knows about Michigan, or if you've seen the movie 8 Mile, there really is an 8 Mile road in Michigan. And I lived exactly 7.5 miles from 8 Mile Road in Michigan. In between 15 Mile and 16 Mile Road is 7.5 miles. Okay, and they really, it's like the Midwest, they took, you know, squares. That's a real, it's for real. Mile by mile squares. And I lived there, and moving there was like, I may as well run into that wall head first at 150 miles an hour. Because it was a different world. I grew up in nice little upper middle class Bethesda, Maryland. And I had just moved to a place called Mount Clemens, Michigan, outside of Detroit, at the end of the 70s, when they were laying off auto workers by tens of thousands a week. Okay? And it wasn't like racial tensions were a thing of the past. They were still there. It wasn't like crime was a thing of the past. At that time, Detroit's in a place called Wayne County. And you didn't, if your car broke down in Wayne County, you didn't leave your wife and kid with the car. Because by the time you got back, the wife would be raped or murdered, and the kid would be, you know, killed too. And your car would be stripped. That's what it was like. I would hitchhike, and people would say, do not get dropped off in the middle of Detroit. I talked to a guy who knew a guy who had hitchhiked all the way from Miami, Florida. And if anybody's ever come up out of Florida, coming up from Miami is just, you know, 5,000 miles long coming up out of Florida. All the way from there, everything went fine until he got to Detroit. Bang, dead. That's the way it was. And what I learned was, I learned about fear like I had never known. And I had no people skills on top of that because all I did was drink and do drugs. So the way I met people is, you want to get high, you want to drink, and that's what I did. And I learned things like, I mean, in Bethesda, I thought I was tough. And I'm like, I don't look behind me. I don't get scared. In Michigan, if you thought something was behind you, you better look because chances are there were. My stepfather, in the 3 years that I lived with my mother and stepfather there, he was, you know, robbed 3 different times coming out of a bank at gunpoint. And the last time, he said he was lucky he didn't get killed. The only reason he didn't is because some semi came by and saw this guy walk him into a field. And the guy probably thought there was a witness, so he let my stepfather go. That's what I walked into. That's the type of fear I learned about. I learned about, you know, so, and those were the lessons I was learning. Like I said, I learned about, you know, the things that I learned, the things that were going into my mind. I learned if you get out of your car to fight somebody, you don't get out without a bat in your hand because they're getting out with something. You know, those are the things I learned. And like I said, I wasn't a tough guy. I was terrified. But you get enough booze and drugs in me, I'd do anything. And I'm like, you know, I graduated when I was 18, and I graduated, and like I said, was supposed to visit with my parent, my sister. I didn't see her. I moved back to Washington. My father had gotten sober by then, and thank God he had a good sponsor, because I was trying to move back in the house, and he's like having nothing to do with it. Because I didn't care about my dad's sobriety. I just wanted to be back in the house, so he let me live in my car in his driveway. And I'm 18 years old, living in the car in my father's driveway. My mother's terrified, wondering, you know, what's going to happen to her baby. And I don't care. The only thing I care about is drinking. That's all I want to do. I want to drink, and I want to do drugs, and I want to go to the bar. That's what I do. And by the time I was 19, my father passed away. He left me a bunch of money in less than a year that was up my nose, down my throat, or to lawyers and restitution. And by the time I was 20 years old, I was in a rehabilitation center called Second Genesis, which at that time was a 3-year program. I was looking at 2.5 years in prison for just fighting and drinking and driving. It's the other thing, I'm good at drinking, I'm good at drinking and driving. That's what I do. And I had a friend who said, go to jail, it'll make you a man. I'm thinking, I'm not so sure about that. I wanted no parts of jail. I knew, like I said, I am not a tough guy. I knew it. In my heart of hearts, I knew it. And that place where you don't tell nobody about when you go to sleep, where you just know what's going on, I knew that. So I went to 2 Genesis, and that was, and that really, actually a little bit before that, I'd gone to like one or two meetings, stayed sober for about 2 weeks. But that began, I was 19, 20 years old, that began my journey to sobriety, really. I got sober when I was 26. I came to AA at 19 because of a DWI. A friend of my sister was sober at the time, and my sister's friend was sober. She took me to my first meeting. And it was a good meeting. There's nothing wrong with the meeting. There's something wrong with the idiot sitting in it, but there's nothing wrong with that meeting. I wanted no parts of AA. I didn't like AA. I liked drinking. And in my mind, you know, we were joking with the waitress at the restaurant because they had apple cobbler and not apple pie. And my buddy looks around and says, "Ain't this America? Where's the apple pie?" Right? And we're laughing and joking. But that's kind of how I looked at drinking beer. It's America. I go to work. I can have a beer. That's how I looked at it. Never understanding, or I do now, but never understanding that I never had one beer in my life unless I just wasn't feeling good. You know, when Nancy Reagan came out with Just Say No, I was like, why? I drink. And when I start drinking, all bets are off. I don't know when I'm stopping. I don't know if I'm spending $10 or if I'm running the credit card, if there's even any money on the credit card, because there usually wasn't. You know, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know if I'm getting arrested that night. I don't know what's going to happen. But I'm going to play the hand till it ends. That's what I do. And I get home, and usually I got home and got to work, because I needed the money enough to work, you know, not to work, to, you know, buy booze. And I wasn't interested in living on the streets. I just didn't think that I'd do very well at that. So I, you know, could maintain enough to get to work. But I went to 2 Genesis, like I said, and I managed to graduate from there. And 18 months later, I moved to Vermont to go to school. I'm sober. But here, and I told you before that I did the things that the people do with the people I hang out with. I said that very poorly. I am a creature of my surroundings. Because I have, especially when I was drinking, I have no integrity. I have no character. I have no self-respect. So I will do whatever it is the people are doing that I'm with. When I got sober with a bunch of people who were like sickeningly enthusiastic about being sober. Like, I thought there was something seriously wrong with these people. But as a result, I do what they do, whether it means drive down here to speak, whatever it is. Go to conferences, you know, go to meetings every day, which I tend to do. I am a creature of my surroundings. So I leave this therapeutic community sober. I didn't want to go to AA. I'd been to AA, didn't like AA, don't want to go to AA. But at least in 2 Genesis, I was surrounded by sober people doing what they're doing at that place, though it really was getting on my head. So, being sober. Because I'm not going to meetings. There's nothing getting communicated to me about not drinking. Now, I wasn't at some big, hard drinking university. I was at some little environmental school in Vermont. Or I probably would have drank at school. There was some drinking, not tons, but, you know. So, I can still meet. And the first semester I'm at the school, I'm calling back to the people I was in treatment with and staying in contact with them. And I'm talking to them daily. And I feel okay as long as I have that contact with those people. As long as I'm talking to them and telling them what's going on in my life, I'm not keeping secrets. There's no secret about, you know, the drugs in the morning when I was a little kid. I'm not hiding that stuff, that kind of thing. I'm talking to people. But eventually, because I'm not going to AA, and eventually I stop talking to these people, I become that isolated, lonely person again. I got one. It's the only answer I got. And that summer I came back to Washington and I managed to stay sober, or dry, or whatever you want to call it. But I was hanging out with my old buddies who were drinking. I'm going to bars with them and, you know, but I'm not drinking. But I'm not going to AA. Occasionally I'd go over to my rehab and see people, but nobody there. I didn't know anybody there anymore. And my closest friends in that rehab had all relapsed by that time. And so I'm this isolated person again. And, you know, I had a friend who was selling cocaine, and one night I said, give me a line, baby, line it up. And I did coke all that night. And I woke up the next day just feeling horrible. And somehow I managed to stay dry, clean, whatever, for another 11 months. Went back to that school, graduated with a 2-year degree, and I moved back to Michigan, and within a month, I'm drinking. Because I drink. If I don't have Alcoholics Anonymous or something else, I'm drinking. The only way I've ever stayed sober for any length of time has been being in Alcoholics Anonymous and being with people just like me, who think like I do, who do the things that I do when I'm drinking. Okay? And I got lucky. I got involved with a group of people, a bunch of young people, who just were enthusiastic about being sober. You know, and I was 10 years older than a lot of them. And they would just make me crazy some days. But they were sober. And we were laughing, and I had this, you know, he met my sponsor's wife a couple weeks ago. My old Italian sponsor. He didn't care what I thought. He's like, we're doing this. I'm like, okay. He'd be like, get in the car. I get in the car. And he took me all over, and people took me in. And I started, you know, so, like I said, what you know, I go to this college, and I drink, and that started 3 years, longest 3 years of my life. So in 1989, when I got here, I was in trouble again. I'd gotten arrested for DWI again. And what happened was I was going to Manassas each week. I live in Rockville. I live actually now right near where I lived when I got sober. And I would drive from Rockville, Maryland to Manassas every Thursday night for this ASAP class because I had gotten banged for my last DWI in Woodbridge. And about halfway through, the guy asked me, have you quit drinking? And I go, no. You said we didn't have to quit drinking. You said no drinking on Thursdays. He didn't say that. That's what my head heard. They suggest you stop drinking for 17 weeks. All I hear is, and if they catch you drinking on Thursday, you either got to go to, you're either going to court or you're going to rehab. That's your option. And he says, well, if you don't stop drinking till the end of this course, I got to send you back to court. I'm pissed. There's only 6 weeks left, but I'm pissed. I'm pissed because this guy's saying this to me. But why I'm really pissed off is because I know in my heart of hearts I can't not drink for 6 weeks. At the end, there was no way. And I wasn't drinking every day, but I knew there's no way I'm not drinking for the next 6 weeks. No way. Especially if you tell me I got to not drink. Then it really ain't happening. Okay? And what I didn't know then was that what happened is that I had just surrendered to the fact that I'm powerless over alcohol. I certainly couldn't have told you that's what happened, but I know in retrospect that is what happened. I accepted in my heart of hearts at that moment that I was powerless over alcohol. Though I didn't have that vocabulary, didn't have those words. That's what happened. And I didn't stay sober from that night to this. Okay? But something happened. A couple weeks later, August the 12th actually, I'm drinking and doing coke like I always did. I'm with my best friend. And he's like, how you doing? I'm like, I'm fine. Lying. I'm just miserable. And I went to sleep that night. And I woke up the next day. And what I didn't understand was that the grace of God was going on in my life. I was behind on court slips, and I had to go to a meeting that night. And somewhere between the time I went to sleep and the time I woke up, God, as I won't even try to explain to anybody because I don't even understand it, removed from me the compulsion to drink and use drugs. So if you believe that you got to be here, you know, you got to ask God, want to be sober, I'm here to tell you, no, you don't. I didn't want to be sober. I never asked God in the beginning to get me sober. I didn't want to be sober. I didn't like Alcoholics Anonymous. There was people in Alcoholics Anonymous. People scare me on a good day. Okay? And when I went to bed, I wasn't thinking about AA. I wasn't thinking about going to a meeting. And I woke up that next day and I went to a meeting. That night. And it was a Sunday night. Almost 20 years ago now. And the meeting was on willingness. And I knew somewhere in my mind, in my just sick mind, I knew if I could be willing long enough, I had a shot at this thing. But I didn't even know what this was. I had no idea what Alcoholics Anonymous is or was. I didn't know. And what I have found in the 19 years that I've been here, that it's everything that I've ever needed. And everything that I ever wanted has come from Alcoholics Anonymous in one form or another. And it all, really, what has happened is it has come about as a result of being willing just a smidgen at a time, willing to listen to someone else. My sponsor and I will laugh a lot about, you know, at a certain level. It doesn't matter who you talk to. I need to talk to people. I would go into meetings just yelling just about because I was so angry and so scared. So, and I'd get all this crap out when I was new. But at the end of the day, you can get that out. You can share and share and share and share and just, you know, puke on a meeting after meeting if you want. But at some point, I better have somebody I'm listening to. Because I'm still this guy with the ideas about telling the truth. I'm still the kid who has these ideas about relationships based on seeing my mother kiss this man that ain't my dad. And then pack everything she has, say I love you, and leave with this same man. And watching my dad cry in the kitchen. I still have all those old ideas and all those things that I acted out on that came out in my fourth and fifth step. And all those resentments. And I have no idea what to do with any of it. I'm just standing there sober going, goody, goody, ain't this fun? Let's go to the next sober party with more cookies and milk. Just shoot me. Okay? That's not really how I felt. I'm like, no, I'm not doing this. And my sponsor was like, yes, you are. Get in the car. I'm like, okay. And what happened is I say this all the time, and you know, my wife tries to get me to be better, but and maybe one day I will get better. But my sponsor was a great listener. Still is. And more importantly, is he has always known how to talk to me. And he's a great manipulator too, because he always tends to be able to get me to do the important things. And I spent hours and hours and days and weeks and just tons of time with my sponsor. Because I was insane when I got here. I couldn't sit still. People didn't, you know, my first 2 years, people didn't really want to get near me unless Frank could grab me by the back of the collar and pull me back. Because I was one of those that would beat you up with the big book and walk away laughing. That's how I was. And I wouldn't care what it would do to you. That was so wrong at so many levels. But I didn't know that. It made me feel better. So screw you. That's how I am. I am self-centered and selfish to the core. And what Alcoholics Anonymous and my sponsor have done is slowly, and it's funny, not funny, really what started that was, I don't know about you, and it still happens, but I'll watch somebody like, you know, trip and fall and hit their face, and I'll laugh. And my sponsor's like, what is up with that, dude? Somebody just got hurt and you're laughing. And it's still kind of funny, but at some point something started to change where I'm like, you know what, maybe that person hurts. And he just about threatened me one time. He says, if you don't stop laughing at that kind of stuff, I'm going to smack you in the head. Because what he understood was that though it was kind of funny, he knew what my laugh was about. It wasn't about that it was kind of funny. It was something, it was worse than that. It was that somebody's hurt and now I feel better kind of thing that was going on there. And what my sponsor was trying to get me to understand was, that's not what we do here. What he was trying to get me to understand was, hooray for me and hooray for you. Let me help you. Let me help you get what you need. Let me help you stay sober one day at a time. Let me help you. Let me be there for you. And he's the best example I've ever seen in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I believe I am a very poor, poor imitation of my sponsor. Because I just ain't that patient. Generally. Generally, I get frustrated. I mean, and I'm 19 years sober. I got the talk from the owner of my company that I've gotten from every job I ever had this past week. And I'm good at my job. And the talk was, your attitude sucks. Now, my sponsor said, well, maybe if he'd give you your money back after the pay cut, your attitude would be better. And that's true. But, at the same time, I stayed with the company. So if I'm going to stay there, I better have a good attitude. Because, you know, if I don't like it, then I can leave. And the reality is I've been looking for a new job, but that doesn't excuse how I treat those people. Not even a little. I still have to learn those lessons. I still have to take my inventory in that manner. I'm probably going to have to go back to a grandbaby, and I've been thinking about it since Friday, and probably apologize to him, and I don't want to apologize to him, you know, because I don't necessarily like apologizing. But AA has allowed me to do that. When I first got sober, I worked fixing copiers. And I would come in the morning, and like I said, I would growl at people. And my nickname at this job was Mr. Attitude, and it wasn't because I had a good attitude. And whether it's a blessing or a curse, I've always had enough of a personality or something where people kind of like me, so they're always hoping that maybe the attitude will turn at some point. Somewhere at some point, maybe it'll turn. But I had to, one of the first things I started to do was I would walk in and I would say good morning to people. And I try to hold doors as best I can. I try to say ma'am or thank you dear or whatever. Something just to be a little bit kind. There's people I know I'll walk through the meeting. I might not talk to many people at the meeting sometimes, but I'll walk by and just touch them on the shoulder to be friendly. And I learned all of those things here. Because at the end of the day, I'm still afraid of people. They still scare me. Because you're people. I just don't know what to do with you. I just don't get it. You know? And really, it's the same old story. It's really, you know, what I'm afraid of is you might go nanny, nanny, boo-boo to me. Really. That's all it is. And I've been able to do things and make amends and go places and experience things in sobriety that would never have happened if I still drank. My older sister who moved to California at one point, she explained to me that the parks in California are warm. And what that meant was I was free to visit for a week. But after a week, you're out. But the parks are warm. To where that same sister made my wife and I the guardian of her kids. She was going to make me the guardian even before I got married. I used to steal from her, lie to her, threw suitcases at her. You know, her kids will come visit me this summer. When my mother was sick, I was able to be there and take care of her. Change her, bathe her, change her IV, do the things that just, you know, I'm glad I didn't miss it. But if you had told me when I got sober that I would have to go and do those things for my mother, and it would be one of the greatest gifts I ever got in sobriety, I'd look at you like, excuse me? I'm sorry, this does not look like a gift. But it was one of the greatest gifts I've ever gotten. I was there for her. And I knew that I couldn't do that. I'm not that kind of guy. I am not, you know, I don't know about you, but I would look on, I look at men, and I go in my mind, I go, I'm not one of them. Now, I may be 46, and they call me a man, but I'm not one of them. I don't know how to do the things that my brain comes up with that men do. Now, granted, I'm probably coming up with all the wrong ideas of what men do, but whatever those ideas are, I can't do those things. Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me to do those things. It's given me the tools to do those things. It has given me the ability to show up for life in a way that I knew I never could. Showed up for my mother. My stepfather, who I came to love dearly until he divorced my mother, at which point I really got pissed off. And then when we buried my mom, I basically looked him right in the face and I said, you will be here and sit with her and I don't care. You will sit with my mother, because he was my mother's best friend. Even after that, my mother loved that man. And my sisters were just wanted him out of it. And I'm like, no. He will sit with her because my mom wanted him there. And then after the funeral, I didn't talk to that man again for 5 years. I was so pissed off and resentful. And what happened was, has always been the case in AA, I crossed paths with him again. I had to, because I hadn't been back to my mom's grave. And I knew kind of where it was, but I knew he knew exactly where it was. So I had to contact him. And I said, look, where's mom's grave? And he gave me, and I said, look, I'm going to be up there at this time. And if you want to meet, I'm willing to meet with you. And he jumped at the chance. He wanted to meet with me. And I hadn't planned this next part when I saw him. I hadn't planned it at all. And what happened was, because of inventory and because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was able to understand my part in this whole relationship. See, that man, my mom moved. I met that man when I was 10 years old. By then, I'm 40, close to it. Yeah, 41. 40, 41 years old. For 30 years, that man had done exactly what he promised my mother he would do. He would take care of her kids in whatever capacity we would allow him to be in our life. Whatever capacity. I had never, ever given him his due credit for that. And through inventory, I finally saw it. And when me and him and my wife drove over to my mom's grave, I was able to say that to him. And for the last 5 years of his life, he died this past year, I was able to call him once a month and go see him. And he came down and helped me remodel my kitchen. My friend Travis here met him. He's a great man. He had faults like everybody else, but he loved me. And AA allowed me to let go enough to let him back into my life. To be his son, really. My dad died when I was 19. That man never tried to replace my father, ever. He never spoke poorly of my father, nothing. He just tried to do what he promised my mother he would do. So that when I went back to Michigan to bury him, my sisters were there and they were in a bunch of pain. I was not. I hurt because I was going to miss him, and I still miss him. Just like I miss my mother, I hurt because I missed my mother. But I wasn't in gut-wrenching, god-awful pain because I had no regret. I had done what I was supposed to do, what I think men do, or women for that matter, I guess. I'm not a woman, so I don't know. But I had done it because of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA is the only thing that's ever enabled me to do that. And I'll end with this last little thing, and it's another amen, but it sticks with me. And it wasn't that the problem between me and this guy was real big. And it's not even that we even, you know, after this amen, actually, that we even talked, because we didn't talk. But for those of you who know about Facebook, there's people from my past that I have, like, obviously crossed paths with. And I sent I want to friend you. And the guy replied back, like, you do understand who this is. Like, you and I didn't just kind of get into it. We, like, got into it occasionally. And my first thought was, yo, man, why don't you let go? And I'm thinking, yeah, if it was that easy. But I thought about it for a little bit, and I'm like, because I wasn't sure how I wanted to reply to this guy. And I had to think about it. And I'm like, yeah, we did. And what I replied back was, look, I'm sorry. I said, you know, somebody sent me your name, and I remembered, and I just, you know, I thought about it, and I thought, you know, let me friend you. And I said, if there's, you know, whatever harm I have caused you, tell me what I do need to do to make it right. And I'll do that. And the only reply back I got from him was, friend. Now, that's just a little everyday thing in my mind. But just maybe the spirit of the ninth step is right there. Because if I see this guy, it's all cool. And there's a bunch of little ones like that that I have on my ninth step still. People that I'm kind of nervous to see because it's just little stuff like that. Though it's getting short. And I had another one with a friend of mine, and I will for sure end with this. And really, to me, the amend was, many years ago, I stole from him a 1909 VDB penny. Now, if it had been a VDBS, my wife would have been really annoyed, because that's about $1,500. So the money part, I was grateful it wasn't that one. But I understood in my heart what I had done. Because he collected coins. And I had a friend who got me one. And I took it to him. And I returned the coin. And I made the apology. So if there's little amends, little stuff like that, that are just nagging at you, try and clean them up. And certainly it's been my year for that. And there's some more that, you know, are going to come to me at the end of the summer. That I have to deal with. Only because of Alcoholics Anonymous am I able to do that. Only because of AA. Only because of these steps. Thank you very much. That's it.